This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll hear about religious exemptions for the vaccine and changes that could be coming to the process. A reminder, this show is not live. We're joined now by Justin Hicks, workforce development reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Justin, welcome back. What got your attention to cover this story?
Hey, Miriam. Yeah, so I've been watching this for kind of a while, actually, probably since maybe September or so. So back when President Biden first kind of announced that there would be some sort of OSHA-related vaccine, quote-unquote, mandate, and I'll say I use quote-unquote because, you know, there is the option to get tested as well, so it's mandate or test. But when that first started, I started looking into, okay, well, you know, what are kind of the parameters around vaccinations? And I was not the only one. So I started noticing on Facebook some groups in Indiana who were actually going on tour, going around the state and kind of doing these workshops with people all around the state who were, you know, kind of worried about their employer's vaccine policies. And they tried to, you know, they wanted to find ways to circumvent that. And one of the ways that was frequently brought up was religious exemptions. So I was covering this and kind of watching it for a little while, went to a couple of the rallies at the State House around vaccine mandates, and just been watching it. And then when this recent bill came up in the Indiana State Legislature that proposes to make some rules around mandates and around vaccination policies with employers, I thought that this was really the time to kind of hit this story hard and do something about it.
Is there any data right now on how many companies are mandating the vaccine and how many employees are asking for exemptions here in Indiana?
There's not a lot of data on this, no, because this is really a company-by-company policy at this point. This is not dictated by OSHA. Remember that the OSHA vaccine, quote-unquote, mandate has been blocked by the court for the time being. And in fact, all the other mandates, the one for federal contract workers and one for Medicare, Medicaid payments for healthcare workers, all this has been blocked. So right now, if you do have a vaccine policy at your work, that is totally voluntary. That is your company's decision. And, you know, we don't really have a lot of data. We don't have a lot of there's no good clearinghouse that I know of, per se, that has a definitive source that says, here's how many companies have this policy and here's how many don't. So,
mm-hmm. Well, just to clarify, because you mentioned that it's a voluntary thing for companies. So this is on a case-by-case basis that a company will decide that they want their employees to show proof of vaccination.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So this would be a company's voluntary decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does this religious exemption process work right now? What do employees do if they want to ask for it?
Yeah, so it's different in different places. In some places, you may be asked to fill out a couple pages of questions that say, you know, what exactly about this vaccination policy is it that interferes with your religion? You know, give us a couple cents of explanation. You know, and it could be a couple pages of questions to maybe even just, hey, you know, come into my office for maybe 5 minutes. Let's talk about this. Or it could just be, you know, some companies may have a policy too that, if it gets requested, you kind of just nod and you say, okay, and you follow that. So, I mean, it's really a company-by-company policy basis. As I'm sure we'll hear later on in the program, though, you know, you want to stick to whatever policy you have. You want to make sure that you stick to that same policy because otherwise you could get into a little bit of legal trouble if you start changing your policy for COVID vaccinations versus other vaccinations.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm curious how it just seems like a lot of stuff around COVID seems so new and different when there have been vaccine mandates or other types of things from the past that I don't know if there's been much backlash for, or maybe there has been. But
yeah,
are there?
It's definitely been politicized. I mean, at this point, it is a scientific process, right? That has been politicized for better or worse. So.
Yeah, I'm just thinking back a show that we did a while back about just the history of these things. And it seems like every time a new vaccine comes out, there seems to be this cyclical nature where there's a lot of pushback and then people forget and move on. But are there other reasons workers can ask to be exempt from a vaccine mandate aside from religious belief?
Yeah, and so again, this varies company to company, but typically a lot of companies also have medical exemptions as well. And those are a lot more, I don't want to say clear cut, but they're a lot easier to quote unquote prove maybe than a religious belief because, you know, you literally go to your doctor and your doctor can sign a form that says, you know, this person's immunocompromised, this person has some kind of other condition. You know, there is sort of that paper trail. But medical exemptions, I think, are offered at most places. I believe some places, because this is a company by company policy as well, some companies may, you know, be encouraging vaccinations, but they may also have ways to say, if this is really going to be a sticking point, we may offer some accommodations based upon, you know, a belief of conscience, not necessarily a belief of religion, but a belief of conscience. If you feel like it's not right for you, you can opt out. So again, every company has its own policy. It really varies. It runs the gamut from, you know, you must get vaccinated to we would really like for you to get vaccinated.
But ultimately, isn't it that whether someone gets a religious exemption or not, they're still going to have to test, right? For COVID, at least?
Perhaps. I mean, again, it's the company's policy. In the OSHA mandate, which again is being blocked by the courts, it seems like there would be some sort of testing for people with religious exemptions. But again, currently, because this is company by company policy, there probably is not going to be testing if you get an exemption.
Oh, that's really interesting, because that kind of throws a wrench in things a little bit.
Well, I mean, if you're a company, you can think about this too. I mean, if you're a company, you don't necessarily want to have this swath of people who then you have to be breathing down their necks to make sure they get tested every so often. Maybe. You know what I mean? It's when you consider these are all voluntary policies, it makes a lot more sense to think about, you know, they're not mandating testing. And some places may do that, but it's not like a legal requirement or anything.
Are you hearing any sort of detailed reasons why people ask for a religious exemption? Are there common arguments that you hear?
Yeah, I mean, I think the arguments are what we've heard from people for months now who say they don't want to get vaccinated. You know, it's things like, you know, it's too early. I want to see what's happening with other people who get vaccinated, or I just feel like this isn't right for my body. You know, it runs the gamut, again, from people who just maybe don't feel comfortable for personal reasons to maybe people who have gotten a lot of disinformation about, you know, microchips and vaccines or things like that seem a little bit out there. You know, it really runs the gamut. Those are the kind of things that they're hearing when people are requesting for accommodations, I would imagine, you know, people just saying that I don't think this is right for me.
You talked to a pastor in Noblesville who said he's getting messages from people about this. What are they telling him?
Yeah, so this is Micah Beckwith. He's a pastor in Noblesville, and he ran for the U.S. House about a year or two ago, I think. So, I mean, he's pretty openly, you know, out there as a conservative. You know, he told me that people call him very, very frequently and just say, I'm really scared. My company is telling me to do this thing. I don't really know how to get out of it. I know that this is not right for me. You know, they have very deeply held beliefs that this is not right for them. And they may not necessarily be able to say, you know, quote the scripture or be able to say, you know, this deity told me that it was not right for me. But, you know, just a deeply held belief that they have personally. And so Micah will help them. And kind of talk through this with them and kind of help them with some of the, you know, scriptures that they might be able to use if they're Christian from the Bible, you know, or maybe other justifications that are very neatly linked to biblical scriptures. I mean, he's really hearing from people who just aren't comfortable and they're very deeply feel uncomfortable about this. And he's kind of helping them see that in a religious light.
Do we know how many times someone's request for exemption has been denied? Is it common here in Indiana?
So we don't know. And again, because it's a company by company policy, it's really hard to tell. I mean, looking at some previous reporting that I have seen, I know one of our colleagues at Indiana University, Brock Turner, has reported that over there, they say maybe about 1 in 12 in the IU health workforce there received religious accommodations. So, I mean, that's relatively significant. And on the other hand, we know that there are some companies as well that have not granted a lot of religious accommodations. One of them that keeps coming up and that we heard about in the legislative hearings and session a week or two ago was Extension Health. We know a lot of their employees have said that they requested accommodations and did not receive them. So, you know, it can run the gamut. It can be, you know, some companies may have a lot of exemptions and they may grant them pretty widely, and other companies may look at it very, very closely.
I wonder also, when it comes to religious exemptions, what religious leaders in the community would be okay signing off on, and are there some, disagreements, like, you know, if you come to somebody and say, can you sign this for me? I need a religious exemption. They're like, nope, I'm not going to do that. You're going to get the vaccine. Have you heard of that at all?
Not necessarily. And I should say, too, that people don't need to have you don't need to have somebody kind of sign on to say, I vouch for this person. Right. So it's not required. I think people like to have that kind of support. I think it's just a human thing. Right. You know, when you're going to request an accommodation, you want to have kind of that backup behind you. So yeah. You're not alone. And I think, you know, going to your local, you know, pastor or, you know, whatever the religious leader you want to go to is and asking for their help. That, you know, I think that's just a human comfort thing. It's not a requirement, though. For the most part, you know, anyone can just walk up to their employer and say, you know, I don't believe that this is, you know, right for me, and I'm going to request a religious accommodation. That could suffice in some cases, you know, to serve as your religious exemption request. Again, at some companies, though, they may have paperwork for you to fill out, and they have more of a documented process. But you don't need someone to sign on in your favor. To that point, though, I will say a lot of religious leaders from a lot of the major religions around the world, you know, and when I say major, it's just being sort of the largest documented religions, you know, so a lot of Christian leaders, a lot of Muslim leaders, other religions as well, they've said, we support vaccination. So if you're going from all the way from the top to down kind of thing, there does seem to be support from religions to vaccinate. But of course, religion is a personal thing, and that is each individual person can have their own spin on those beliefs.
And that's Justin Hicks, workforce reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Coming up, we will hear about the history of Filipino nurses in the U.S. and how the pandemic has impacted the community. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday Recap, where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Next up, the history of Filipino nurses in the U.S. and how the pandemic has impacted the community. We're joined now by Zeni Triunfo Cortez, president of National Nurses United, to learn about finding data on healthcare worker deaths from COVID-19. Welcome to the program, Zeni.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Zeni, what prompted your group to work on this report?
First and foremost, we are the largest nursing organization, association, union group in the United States. We represent over 175 nurses throughout the country. And it is just but fitting that we protect our nurses as well as the healthcare workers that we work along with. And so this is really important to us.
This report was released earlier this year in March. What numbers and data did you find then?
Well, we put together the Sense of Omission report. And because there was lack of reporting and transparency among healthcare agencies that should be looking into this, and also our government, unfortunately, we, as an organization, started looking into the statistics, and it's very heartbreaking, and I still continue to choke up, that we have registered nurses of 476 who have died and about 4,184 healthcare workers who have died due to COVID. And we know that this is underreported because our organization was looking at obituaries, GoFundMe accounts. You know, there was really no hard data or consistent reporting that was being done. And so we took the task of really looking into public records so that we could come up with the numbers. So again, with over close to 5,000 healthcare workers, including nurses, we know that it is underreported.
So sad to hear that there's no way to keep track of this information. And it sounds like your group is on the forefront of trying to make sure that, that it's out there. Did the numbers surprise you?
It really didn't, because at the beginning of the pandemic, when we first heard about this from our colleagues from around the world, we generated a letter to the World Health Organization and to our CDC that and OSHA, that there is a virus that's killing healthcare workers around the world. Maybe the government, the U.S. government, should look into this. And I think we also copy furnished the former president, and of course it fell on deaf ears. You know, just so maybe they were looking at a bunch of wimpy nurses. But it was really concerning because our colleagues from other countries were dying, and we knew it was just a matter of time that it would be coming here in the U.S., and so it did.
Have the numbers changed since the report was released? Have you seen any differences?
Well, I think there's a slight increase, but again, because of the lack of consistent reporting and transparency, it's still very hard to track the numbers. Different states have different ways of doing it, but again, there's no consistent manner of which reporting is done. And so it's still very concerning because we hear from friends, colleagues, you know, again, public records, obituaries, GoFundMe accounts, that nurses and other healthcare workers are still dying.
If you're tuning in and have a question or comment for our program, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Zeni Triunfo-Cortez, president of National Nurses United, to learn more about finding data on healthcare worker deaths from COVID-19, as well as the effect of the pandemic on the Filipino-American community and healthcare workers. Zeni, you mentioned that finding the data was really hard, and you had to go through these obituaries or GoFundMes. What I was wondering is part of the problem that a cause of death isn't always linked to COVID, even though, let's say, someone died of COVID, they might say it was something else?
Well, that's a possibility. That's a good, accurate statement that you're making. And it's really, again, concerning that, you know, it's not just coincidence that a nurse would die during this pandemic when they're extremely or actively exposed to the elements of their workplace.
Is there enough being done to record the number of healthcare worker deaths right now?
I think the Biden administration is trying, but again, there's still lack of cooperation among the states. And not to pick on Indiana, where this radio show is coming from, but the state of Indiana has never publicly reported all healthcare worker infections or deaths. And our organization has counted about 90 healthcare worker deaths in Indiana, including 8 registered nurses during the pandemic. Just again, using the data sources that we have been using, which is the news report, social media, GoFundMe campaigns, and the federal CMS nursing home data set. But again, there's no consistency and again, no transparency, which is really heartbreaking for me and for all of us.
Is this transparency and lack of transparency something new to the pandemic, or has this always been an issue within the industry?
I think it has always been that way in the industry, and more so with this pandemic. I mean, it has just exacerbated it, because I guess the hospital industry, the healthcare industry, does not want to take full account of how the healthcare workers, the nurses, were not protected at the beginning of the pandemic, when we were asking, begging, crying for personal protective equipment. And even the regulators, you know, the healthcare agencies like OSHA, the Department of Health, all of them were saying that, you know, you don't have to wear a mask. A bandana would suffice. Mm-hmm. But we know it's not, because, again, we have been informed and we know what was going on around the world. And even in some hospitals, nurses were disciplined for wearing masks. And, you know, the managers and supervisors were saying that we were raising a lot of alarm, you know, unnecessary alarm, or, you know, we were scaring our patients. But we were trying to protect ourselves, because if we are not protected, then the people that we care for are not protected as well. And so that was the beginning. And then we kept pushing and crying and begging. And ultimately, with the help of our union, we were able to secure the proper personal protective equipment, but not all of the nurses or healthcare workers in other states, where, again, they were retaliated when they spoke out in the public about not being protected. And it's like James had said in the beginning, you know, we go home to our families, we interact with the communities. If we're the carriers of the virus, it's, again, not right. It's unconscionable that we will be the perpetrators of this pandemic. And so we wanted to protect the public as well as protect ourselves.
You know, I almost forgot about the early pandemic days, and I'm now remembering the lack of PPEs and all of that stuff that was going on. And now, knowing what we know, I mean, that just sounds so scary to have to have experienced that. What was that like for you?
For me, it was very concerning, heartbreaking, and fortunately or unfortunately for me, I do not have my elder parents. They have been gone, but I have grandnephews and grandnieces that I once in a while would see, that, you know, again, fortunately, they don't live with me. But every day that you come to work, you never know whether you'll be able to make it through another day. You never know whether you will be hit with the virus. You never know whether you have enough protective equipment to use for the day. Because back in the day, we were told to keep reusing the same masks, the same gowns, over and over. And back in the day also, they were not isolating COVID positive patients. We were taking care of non-COVID patients with the COVID positive patients. So who's to say that we were not cross-infecting, you know, the patients? But I don't know what was it with the hospital industry that they don't understand. The nurses and the healthcare workers are there with the patients. We are there 24/7 at the bedside. And yet, these folks who are making the decisions are in their offices, high up in their offices, protected within the four walls of their offices. They do not know what was going on at the bedside. That's why we were begging, crying. And I remember coming home each night, laying awake all night, thinking that, did I come home with the virus? Am I giving it to my husband? Or if I go back to work again, will another patient die? Or will I, again, hold the hands of a dying patient because families are not allowed to come in? So those were the kinds of thoughts that, you know, keep going through our minds. And I think even to this day, a lot of the nurses are just tired, not just physical, but mentally tired. And we are all suffering from moral distress, meaning that we knew back then that we wanted to do the right thing, but we were pushed not to because of the lack of resources and the lack of support.
Yeah, that's got to be tough. Just everything that you're talking about, you know, I'm really sorry you had to go through all of that. And I hope that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, we thank you and everyone who's been working on the front lines. When we talk about the effect of the pandemic on the Filipino healthcare workers, do you have any numbers on how it's been impacting that community?
Yeah, sure. Again, the numbers would be underreported, but what we have is that there are 476 registered nurses that we know of who have died, and we were only able to identify the ethnicity of 455 of those nurses. Out of those 455 that we were able to identify, we know that 221 of them are nurses of color. Then out of the 221 nurses of color who have died, 96 of those are Filipinos. And if you look at the percentage, it's a high percentage of Filipino nurses, you know, who have died because of COVID. And for the Black nurses, there's 78 of them. And for the Latinx nurses, there's 34. So within the colored group of nurses, the Filipinos rank the highest.
And it also sounds just in general, nurses of color are more impacted, or am I understanding that?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement to make. It's again, it's unfortunate that it has to come to that. I think for Filipinos, I might say, is that a lot of us work in the critical care area where a lot of the very sick COVID patients are housed. And so we had a higher rate of exposure because of that. We also because of the lack of PPE. And I think it's, again, a statement that I have made. Filipinos culturally are not the ones who would rock the boat or make waves to complain, because they treat their patients like their families. We just go with it. We use the best of what we have, given what we have, and continue to do the work. And I think that was when we lacked the PPE, we were overworked, and we were overstressed, and that we would forego of our own safety, you know, to care for our patients. And I think that, I would say, are some of the reasons that made up the high rate of Filipino nurses dying.
We're about to take a break, but before we do, can you tell us what protections are in place for nurses and healthcare workers on the front lines right now?
So right now, we do have some of the personal protective equipment that we need, but again, it's not enough, and it's not true for all nurses all over the country. Then we had pushed the Biden administration to issue an emergency temporary standard. And a good thing that President Biden put together a COVID task force and asked OSHA, federal OSHA, to create the first emergency temporary standard since 1983. And this emergency temporary standard, which we call ETS for short, mandates all employers to have written infection control safety standards and implementation plans. It requires employers to issue life-saving respiratory protection and also to admit the fact that COVID is also transmitted via aerosol. And so they are required to provide us with respiratory, you know, one of those hoods. And I don't know if you've seen it, you know, with the astronauts wearing them.
Yeah.
They're required to provide us that if it's needed. And also that they have a robust notification system, you know, to notify employees when they're infected. And then also to provide us with testing, screening, and all of that. But unfortunately, this emergency temporary standard is expiring on December 21st. That's why we're pushing and, again, begging that the ETS be reissued or that it becomes permanent so that we can have the protections that we need.
I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. For our final segment, we'll hear from author Liz Lenz about her book, Godland, A Story of Faith, Loss, and Renewal in Middle America. Liz, you talk in the book about the 2016 election leading to your divorce, and there's been a lot of talk over the years about how divided we are, how polarized the country has become because of politics. What did you learn about that kind of division after it had such a big impact on your life?
I learned that divides are sometimes okay. We talk a lot about, like, oh, it's so bad to be divided. And there's a lot of recent data. I think this last week, Axios came out with a poll about how, you know, Democrats won't date Republicans and Republicans are more willing to date Democrats. And people are like, oh, no, this is so bad. It's fine. I think it's fine. Like, it's a good idea not to date somebody who doesn't think you have a fundamental right to choose your own health care. I think what is actually happening is that it's harder to hide. You know, there's people who are like, oh, I don't like to talk about politics. And it's like, well, maybe that's just because you're privileged enough to be able to hide from the effects of politics, right? But, like, we have to stop pretending like what we do and who we aren't isn't political. I think the pandemic has just revealed to us on so many levels, like who gets to keep their job and who doesn't, who can work at home and who can't, who can stay safe from a virus and who doesn't. When it comes to, you know, two parents in the home and two kids needing to be homeschooled, who's doing those chores? Who's doing the homeschooling? It's everything is deeply political and we can't hide from it anymore. You know, with the child care tax credits, you know, I know people who that tax credit was the difference between, you know, being able to buy groceries and not, right? That's not a small thing. This isn't just, you know, people out there debating ideas about democracy, right? Like, these are the material aspects of our life. This is who can vote and who can't. This is who can go to a Planned Parenthood and who can't, right? And so this is just, it's the nitty gritty of our lives. So I don't think divides are bad. I think what is happening is we just can't hide from it anymore. And that's good because we need to be able to face who we really are as a nation so we can change and do better.
Do you think that knowing where people stand on issues now, because I guess maybe in some ways things have become more transparent, helps further discussion, or does it create more of maybe like an awkwardness where people are just like, I'm not even going to have a conversation with you?
Oh, it's completely impossible not to have conversations. I remember right before 2016, I did this workout with a bunch of ladies in my neighborhood and we do kettlebells. And there was a woman who was just like, I wore like a Hillary Clinton shirt and she got upset. She was like, I want to avoid politics. And I was like, and you know, and at that point, you know, my marriage was falling apart. Like, I was like, because of politics in some ways. And I was like, how can you avoid politics? Like, I was like, how can you? And I was like, oh, right, because you are privileged enough not to have to. And I have, you know, been there at various points in my life. But I of course, there's initial awkwardness. But listen, I love awkwardness because I think in awkwardness is where the essential issues are, you know. And I think that's, it's fine to be awkward. I think it's fine to have arguments and sure, it feels uncomfortable. And a lot of American life is about avoiding discomfort and feeling bad. But like, guess what? 800,000 people are dead. Like, I think maybe we need to move beyond trying to feel more comfortable and better about everything and take a good, long, hard look at who we are. And instead of trying to be more comfortable, try to be better. And when this book came out, you know, I had some interviews where people were like, well, how do we bridge the divide? You know, and I'm like, the end of the book, I'm saying some divides are fine. I'm not offering a solution for like having us all hold hands and sing together. I'm saying that sometimes you got to drop the rope and you got to look at what's broken before you can actually fix it. We can't put a Band-Aid on a broken leg here, folks.
Well, we have a listener voicemail from Lisa who has a comment about separating politics and religion. Let's take a listen.
Hi, this is Lisa in Bloomington. I didn't have a church for many years, and I decided to join one about 15 years ago, largely so that I could feel a sense of community, although mine is far from a mega church. We're quite small. And about politics and religion, I wanted to say that I don't think that you can necessarily separate them in Christianity. I look at the far right evangelicals, and I often get upset, but I think that they think that they're following what Scripture tells them to do. My church is, well, it would be labeled as quite liberal, but actually we're doing what we think that the Bible is telling us to do.
Any thoughts?
Yes. I mean, that's so powerful. And I do think it highlights something that it's really important that there are, you know, a lot of churches out there that are not getting the airtime or the journalism coverage, that are out there, you know, protesting the Muslim ban, that are saying, yes, women have a right to an abortion, that are saying everybody should be able to vote. Because, and I think it's a hard space for a lot of pastors and ministers to occupy because, you know, well, first of all, nonprofit tax reasons. And then also, you know, they want to be ministers to everyone, not just the people they agree with. And, you know, I found that a lot in the book, that, you know, there would be liberal ministers in deeply red areas that had, you know, people who were more conservative than them, and they were pastors to them. Or, you know, on the flip side, more conservative congregants with more liberal-leaning pastors. But, you know, the reality is, no, I don't think if you are a person of faith, and then that's going to impact your politics. You know, growing up from the pulpit, I heard so many pastors say, well, you know, you can't be a Christian and support a vote abortion, so go vote accordingly, right? Like, that's not an explicit, well, that's not telling somebody to go vote for George W. Bush, but it's not saying, you know, it kind of is. And so that weird, twisted way we do politics and religion, and so many people try to sidestep it and say, oh, no, my, you know, religion doesn't inform my politics, but it does. Like, let's just stop lying about it. You know, over 90% of our politicians, our elected representatives are, you know, white Christians. So we need to just like stop pretending, you know, and stop hiding behind the artifice and then saying, okay, well, how does it affect and what aspects, you know, of your religion are controlling your opinions? I mean, we're seeing that with the Supreme Court, right? So yes, that was a very good point by the listener caller.
Well, if you're listening and want to join in with a question or comment, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Liz Lenz, author of Godland, A Story of Faith, Loss, and Renewal in Middle America. Liz, the one thing I was thinking about with the Midwest is it seems like any faith that's in this area is generally conservative. Maybe I'm stereotyping it, but just in my own experiences of like traveling outside of the Midwest, I was like, wow, there's a whole new world out there.
You know, there are so many wonderful mainline denominations and congregations in middle of America that have had to close up, right? Because the farm crisis of the 1980s really dried up a lot of where we live. Small towns had to close, churches had to close. And so I think it really consolidated a lot of those just really small progressive churches. But I did see a statistic, I believe a month ago, that said that if millennials attend church, which is a big if, they seem more likely or increasingly more likely to go to a mainline Protestant church, which is encouraging to me, because hopefully that means that there is a shift away from a more regressive form of faith. But there's a lot of sociology and studies that show the more loud, the more vocal, and even the more regressive a church is, the more likely they are to attract adherents, because it feels powerful. You know, it draws community. And even if you're building community around, you know, a toxic iteration of faith, it does feel louder and more powerful than a group of people who are like, hey, we believe in Jesus and feeding people. Like, so let's just get together and do that. So that, and I think that's why too, in journalism and in the way we talk about faith in America, so many of those conservative evangelicals just take up all the air in the room because of just the loudness and the shouting and the claims of, you know, persecution.
Mm-hmm. Do you think though that there, you know, just to kind of give another side here, that folks in evangelical and conservative circles, there are some that may have liberal leanings that we just don't know about or hear about?
You know, one of the worst articles I did before the 2016 election, and worst, not that I did it poorly, but that it was wrong, is that I wrote a story about the secret Hillary Clinton voters in these conservative communities. And because I thought, yeah, they're quiet, right? Like maybe they're just afraid. Maybe like me, they're afraid to talk about it because their whole lives could blow apart. Their marriages could blow apart. I think and then what post the election we saw, I believe it was 52% of white women ended up voting for Trump. And then I was like, oh, I was wrong. And so I'm sure there are some, but not enough to be a statistical matter. And I think what actually happens more often is the quietness, is the conservatism. I mean, you see in poll after poll of political leaning, you know, even the most trustworthy polls tend to undercount conservative opinions and voices. So I wish it was, but I don't know if the data is bearing that out.
Do you think that religious institutions can change with the times, or is it more the congregants that have to push for that change to happen?
You know, I no longer believe in you know, sitting around and waiting for your toxic Baptist minister to come around on gay rights. Leave. There is a nice little Lutheran, ELCA Lutheran church down the street. You can go there. You know, I think what's happening is, you know, it's 2021. There are, and the history of faith, not just in America, but in the world, is complex. And there are communities of faith that are out there doing the work that you want to do. So there's no reason to persist in a bad space. There's no reason to stay in a bad space unless you're trying to prove something to yourself or you're too afraid to leave. But no, I say leave. Go find the places that are doing the work you want to do, or like be free enough to find and create the faith that you want in the world. You don't have to sit around and grapple with toxic elements. You know, they're theologians. This is one of the things that made me mad. Even just a year ago, one of my best friends is finishing her PhD in the Old Testament, you know, and I'll say something like, oh, something about, you know, a regressive interpretation of the Bible. And she'll be like, hey, Liz, for like 100 years, feminist theologians have been saying, no, that's complete bunk. And I'm like, oh, 100 years, huh? Great, cool. Glad it, you know, still affected my life a couple years ago. But like, you don't have to be there. There's other people struggling and thinking the same thing. So go find them.
Yeah. Well, what would you say I've heard arguments where it's like, but you need to be there to change that space because, you know, you're forward thinking or you have ways to reform things.
Now, you know, one of the things a therapist told me one time about families, and churches are like families, that's why they're so hard to leave. But she's like, imagine you're on like a sinking boat. And that's what a dysfunctional place is. It's just a sinking boat. And some people on the boat are trying to, you know, patch the hole. And some people are trying to bail the water out. And some people are pretending like the boat isn't sinking. And she was like, but the boat's going to sink. So you have to jump off and swim to safety. She's like, that's it. You can't sit around, you know, just save yourself and jump off that dysfunctional boat and go to safety and then change your life and your spirit from there, because you can't work in a place where people aren't respecting you. You know, I experienced this as a woman where I would be talking to ministers and I would be saying things and it would become apparent that they did not respect me specifically because I was a woman, right? And so how can I even have conversations when the people I'm trying to talk to don't even respect me because of who I am? You know, I'd have try to have conversations with the pastor and he'd be like, no, I won't talk to you unless your husband's there. Sir, what? You know, like, you need the presence of a man for you to listen to me? This is not, you can't have those conversations. The power dynamic's not there. And people who tell you to stay, they just want you to persist in that dysfunctional situation. No, get yourself free. Get out of there.
Well, we're about to wrap up. I want to know what makes you hopeful or even concerned about the future as we move forward.
There is a lot of change, you know, like you so smartly pointed out that people's ideas are shifting. You know, they're not going to these churches anymore. Our ideas of what faith is, of what community is shifting. You know, the idea of what is a good neighbor means so much more in 2021 than it even did when this book came out in 2019. And so while it is hard and it's difficult and it's scary and, you know, Lord knows, I don't know if we're going to get better anytime soon, but I think what gives me hope is how many people are trying, you know, and working through this. And if it takes burning it down to rebuild it all up again, And I think that it's so easy to focus on the dysfunction, right? But instead, this gives us an opportunity to reimagine ourselves, our lives, our faith, and our world.
And that was Liz Lenz, author of Godland, A Story of Faith, Loss, and Renewal in Middle America. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.